Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sports Tonight on BSL Radio. Join Rob Shields and Mike Weber as they talk about the Baltimore Orioles, Baltimore Ravens, University of Maryland Terrapins, and more. Be part of the show. Call us at 347-215-8391.
Welcome to Sports Tonight with Rob and Mike. Mike Weber here with Rob Shields. Tonight, we have a couple good guests on coming back to the show. Sid Seraph from Fox Sports and John Gassaway from ESPN. Sid on to talk some NFL. Lots and lots of moves going on in the National Football League. And then John talking some college hoops as we, you know, get into the tournament time here. So exciting time. I know this is Rob's favorite time in sports here, this general time frame. Not quite mine, but, you know, either way, very, very interesting day in the NFL, as I said. We'll start off with some Ravens talk. So Ravens have lost Jimmy Smith to the 49ers. They traded Haloti Ngata to the Detroit Lions, got back a fourth and a fifth, and they traded a seventh in that deal as well. Purnell McPhee went to the Bears in free agency. Owen Daniels went to the Broncos. Maybe I'm missing something, Rob, but those are the main moves I can think of off the top of my head. So let's start off with Torrey Smith. I know you're not a big, huge fan of Torrey. What were your thoughts on him going to the 49ers for, what, 540 with 22 guaranteed?
Yeah, and, you know, the first thought just – as like kind of an umbrella thought to all those moves that you just mentioned, except for Owen Daniels, they all went to the NFC. So that's a positive for the Ravens. You know, these guys aren't really going to come back and hurt them, at least head to head. The Torrey Smith signing, good for him. There's no way I would have approached that contract. I think some of the 49ers issues right now are really overblown. And we'll get into that with Sid Seraph in a little bit here. I mean, I don't think losing Frank Gore is a big deal. Losing Patrick Willis is a big deal. He's great. But Chris Borland is actually pretty good, and he had a nice year last year. And they, you know, I think they can be okay there. and, you know, now they've added Torrey to help. You know, Kaepernick has a big arm. You know, that's never a question about him, is his arm strength, the deep ball, or anything like that. So, you know, that's what he can bring to them. And, you know, he was recruited apparently by Bolden, and, you know, they're close. So, you know, they've got the Ravens receiving core from the Super Bowl that they, you know, losing to the Ravens. So that's kind of interesting. But, you know, I think the 49ers overpaid for him. I think they're going to regret it on some level, maybe not within the first few years, but after that, I don't know how the contract is structured in terms of, you know, if they cut him after three seasons, is it something where, you know, the cap hit isn't really too bad? If that's the case, and that makes the contract a little bit better. But they did give him, you know, a really good amount of guaranteed money, so the contract is going to count for over $4 million on the cap for the 5 years. It's just a matter of how much beyond that. So, you know, good for Torrey Smith. You know, he gave a very classy farewell, you know, thanking almost everybody, which, you know, I thought that was great. You know, he talked about keeping his home in Baltimore. It wouldn't surprise me if things don't work out in San Francisco and he gets cut or something like that, if he ends up back here at some point. But, you know, to me, the Ravens' offer should have been $25 to $30 million at most, with, you know, 12 to 15 guaranteed. I just wouldn't have come close. So good for him for getting the big money. He got what the market dictates that he gets. So it was a fair contract in terms of what the market dictates. I just don't think he's going to be worth it.
I mean, obviously we've disagreed about Torrey before. I think the guaranteed money is high here. It's a much higher, you know, percentage than a lot of the contracts you typically see in terms of guaranteed money versus the overall value of the contract. So that's a bit excessive. I would have easily, you know, been willing to give Torrey more than 5, 25 or 30, but, you know, the 40 with the guaranteed issue, especially if we're talking about from the Ravens' perspective with their cap issues, you know, that'd be tough. I do think Torrey Smith is a pretty big loss for the Ravens, though. We'll see what, if anything, I mean, they'll do something, but what they do to replace him, you know, whether it be a free agent move or in the draft. If it is in the draft, you know, I just wouldn't be very optimistic in terms of at least this season getting anywhere near Torrey Smith level production or what you'd expect from Torrey. Yeah, Torrey's numbers did fall off some this past season. I think some of that was due to the way he was used. I still think he's a huge weapon, and I don't think his numbers are, you know, completely a fair way to evaluate him, because I think he is, you know, one of the very best deep threats in the league, and you can't just measure that in that player's stats. That really affects the whole way the defense plays his offense. So, you know, I think it's a big loss, but I can't really blame the Ravens for not going to the level they would have had to retain him.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's going to depend on what the Ravens do. For example, if they were to draft Devin Smith in the upcoming draft, Devin Smith is from Ohio State, and when they were doing the combine, which I'm sure you sat there and watched with bated breath, Mike Mayock talked about how he tracks the deep ball better than any receiver that he has seen in a long, long time. He might have said ever in terms of how long he's been doing the draft and everything that he does for it. So if they get a guy like that, that is a great deep threat, that's got speed, that, you know, that can get separation, then that certainly takes away from that loss. If they're able to sign a free agent that can do something like that. Now, the question, so now if they don't do that and they don't get that guy that can kind of take the top off the defense, and they struggle with being able to figure out how to open things up with the offense, and if they don't have that, that's when you'll see that become more of an issue. So I think this is one of those things. First of all, like you said, the Ravens' salary cap issues dictated that they couldn't come close to this contract. So that you know, you can sit there, you can play, you know, Tuesday, you know, Monday morning quarterback all we want, but they couldn't do that anyway. But if they wanted to, I think the question ends up being, how do they replace him, and what do they do with the offense? So I don't know that we're going to completely know if it's a good or a bad thing that Torrey Smith is gone until we actually see what they do in the free agency and the draft, and then we see how their offense plays out next season. If it's something where, you know, it's kind of like the Patriots offense, but maybe not quite as crisp and, you know, that type of thing, because Brady is going to be better at that than Flacco. But, I mean, you know, where it's got to be short passes, everything is condensed, that type. If that's going to be the case, then I think then the Ravens offense will probably struggle. But if they're able to figure out a way to run an offense, or they're able to replace Torrey Smith with a similar player, then I don't think it's going to matter. So, you know, it's tough to judge that part of it until we get the rest of it. So at this point, I'm willing to just say he was a valuable player, but a lot of the stuff that he did to help us, I think we can just get a better receiver that can make up in some of the ways that he couldn't help us because he just wasn't able to, whether it was physically, his talent, you know, whatever work that he's put into it, and he just can't translate that to the field or whatever it is. So I think, you know, it's like I think he led the league in something like he got 8 yards more than anybody else per game in pass interference calls. But, you know, are we going to be able to get a receiver who's got better hands and is a better route runner and can make up those 8 yards a game, you know, just catching the ball? I mean, so that's the type of thing that I think we just have to see how it plays out. We have to think with the Ravens and how well that they're run and, you know, how well they can evaluate things, wide receiver maybe being one of the things that they haven't been as great at. But if they're able to overcome him, maybe just in a different way than what they're used to doing. So, you know, that's going to be the second part to this, I think.
Yeah, well, like you said, the Ravens don't have a tremendous track record with receivers. Torrey is one of their biggest hits by far in that department. So, you know, I just wouldn't count on replacing him through the draft this season. You might get someone who, you know, develops, but we'll see. In terms of free agency, you know, we already mentioned cap issues and, you know, there's not necessarily, there's some guys available, but I don't know, you know, if they're realistically involved in anyone. I mean, there's Andre Johnson, Crabtree, some other guys, but you know, I don't know that they are too into those guys at this moment. So, do you have any thoughts on free agent receivers before we move on?
Well, Andre Johnson is a guy. I was actually really surprised on how productive he was last year. I don't know why. I just didn't think he was all that productive. But tons of catches, still getting a decent yards per catch. Yes, you will have two starting receivers that'll be old, but I still think that they're going to use a draft pick early, and you've got other young guys, and quite frankly, you're in position to where you can win right now. So if they're able to afford him and he wants to come here, personally, I think I understand he's like heading to Indianapolis. I'd be surprised if he doesn't end up signing with the Colts. I'm almost surprised right now if the Colts want any free agent, why they don't go there, because it's pretty much a guaranteed playoffs berth. You know, and if on offense you get to play with Luck and stuff. So and they've got a ton of money to spend. So, but I personally think he's going to end up there. But if he doesn't and he's open, I think that is a great target, I think, for the Ravens. Now beyond that, I'm not really sure if anybody jumps out and says, "Wow, this is a great fit. This is the guy to get." But you know, I think we're going to see more guys cut, and you know, the Haloti-Ngata trade maybe has opened up the Ravens' ability to trade some draft picks and maybe add somebody that way too.
Yeah. The extra draft picks that they gained, the fourth and the fifth, they gave up the seventh in the Ngata deal. Yeah, should help them be able to move up or maneuver in the draft. With the Ngata deal, you know, it's, you know, they basically did not want that cap hit. It was going to be, I believe, $16 million. Now they get the draft picks, and they have some very good depth at that position anyway. You know, the issue is that they still have dead money associated with Ngata. I'm not sure, you know, exactly how that affects the cap right now, but there's still, you know, about, I guess, $8 million additional that, you know, from the bonus that they still have to deal with. But, you know, nice to be able to recover some picks for someone that, you know, while still a very productive player, they were planning on cutting anyway, most likely, if they couldn't get a trade.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that they were, you know, look, you know, people will say, well, okay, why did Detroit make this move? Well, Detroit, in my opinion, is way better off with Ngata and all the money than well, you know, all the money that he's owed, minus what he's owed, I mean, versus paying $60 million for Sue. Sue is a better player than Ngata at this point, and Sue is a more disruptive player in terms of getting to the quarterback. But Ngata, when he's healthy, is still really good. And to not have to put in that commitment of the serious money and the potential cap issues down the road, to be able to do that, and, you know, look, you say they only gave up a fourth and a fifth rounder. That's not terrible, considering the alternative of maybe giving Sue $50 to $60 million. I think if I'm a Lions fan, I prefer what they did versus what Miami did. But in terms of the Ravens, you know, I think it's a great move for them. They could not have kept Ngata with his cap number, and we heard the reports that they just were not coming close with him in terms of getting a contract done, because he just felt that he was going to get a lot more in free agency if they had cut him, and he was right. I think the Colts were going to line up and pay him big money, because they were one of the suitors for Sue. So I think he could have gotten $20-30 million from the Colts, so why take a lot less to stay in Baltimore? It was his thought, I assume. So, you know, the Ravens were able to kind of pull a rabbit out of the hat a little bit and get those fourth and fifth rounders. And, you know, they've gotten a lot of productive players in those rounds in the past, but it also allows them to because they're going to get comp picks in those rounds too, so they can maybe take those picks and they can trade them. They can move up, and, you know, whether it's in the first or the second round, or they trade a fourth-round pick for a receiver, you know, something like that. I mean, you know, that makes it a little bit easier for them to maneuver, whether it's in the draft or in free agency. So, and then they save the $8.5 million. So it was one of those trades where I think you have to look at it and say, this is a great deal for both sides. Even if you look at Detroit and say, well, they were going to cut him, so why trade anything? But Detroit wanted to make sure that they were the ones who got him. And they may not have wanted to lock into some 4 or 5 year deal for huge bonus, for huge money, when they can maybe just have him for this year and, you know, and then see what happens after that. So I think it was just a really good move on both sides.
Yeah, what you say at the end there is why I would say saying they kind of pulled a rabbit out of their hat would be a little generous to the Ravens. I mean, he had trade value. I mean, the other team, the team who traded for him, in this case the Lions, doesn't have the same cap hit that the Ravens would have had. It's about half because of the bonus, again, is still the Ravens' responsibility. So plenty of trade value, or not plenty, but enough to get the picks that they got. I'm sure there are other teams that are interested, so it makes sense for the Lions to do what they did. For that reason, the reasons you stated. All right, so McPhee, I guess this was pretty expected. Any thoughts there on losing McPhee?
Yeah, I mean, look, he's gotten tremendously high grades from Pro Football Focus. He's been an excellent pass rusher. The question is can he do it as an every down player, or maybe not every down, but, you know, play a lot more than he's played for the Ravens? I'm a little surprised at the amount that he got, but not that surprised. I think the Ravens, you know, the one thing about the Ravens, a lot of their depth is on their D-line. And I expect the Ravens to sign some kind of veteran defensive lineman, kind of like, you know, in that Chris Canty mold. They're going to get another player like that, I'm sure. And they've got Capron Moore coming back, who they really like, who was injured last year. Brent Urban, who they really like, who was hurt last year. So you get these guys back. Plus, you know, Brandon Williams was one of the best nose tackle, was one of the best inside interior defensive linemen in the league last year. And then Timmy Jernigan, you know, who's had some health issues, whether it was in college or even last year with the Ravens, but he showed a lot of explosion when he played. So I think they're going to be fine, you know, losing these guys. But they do, they'll probably draft somebody, is my guess, and then they'll probably add, like I said, some veteran in free agency to add a little bit more depth. But I think they're going to be fine with that. And, you know, the one thing that McPhee takes away from you is his pass rushing ability. And he can do it from all parts of the, you know, he doesn't just have to come off the edge. He can do it up the middle and that type of thing. So I think as of right now, a pass rusher along with a wide receiver might be the two biggest needs on the team. So they do, especially because their two best pass rushers are getting up there in age. So they're going to need to make some moves in the draft with those positions. But, yeah, I mean, there was never a chance they were going to keep McPhee. And, you know, again, good for him for getting the contract that he did.
Yeah, and you mentioned how he's rated, presumably by Pro Football Focus, and they gave the Bears an A-minus for that signing, despite the big dollar figures there. All right, so, you know, lots of other NFL moves to get into. We're going to talk to Sid Seraph from Fox Sports in a moment and, you know, get into the Ravens as well. You know, their cap issues and the Nada situation specifically. But, yeah, crazy day in the NFL. You know, lots of interesting trades. So let's welcome Sid to the show. Sid Seraph from FoxSports.com. How you doing today?
Hey, how you doing, guys? Good to be back.
Good to have you, Sid. So, Haloti Ngata traded to the Detroit Lions. Fourth and fifth round pick coming back. The Ravens also sending a seventh in the deal. What are your thoughts on that trade?
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I didn't see this one coming from I mean, I was looking at a lot of other potential signings and even trades, but this one sort of really came out of right field for me. It just goes to show that how far apart, I guess, the Ravens and Ngata were in negotiations for an extension, because apparently, you know, they were never really close, and now they just sort of cut bait with him and you know, traded him away to the Lions for a pair of mid-round picks. It was surprising, to say the least, but it didn't seem like the Ravens were that upset by it. You know, they, you know, wished him well on the way out and, you know, complimented him, didn't say anything bad about him, you know, out the door. So, you know, apparently they seem happy with it, and, you know, they'll probably save some save a good chunk of change on having to pay his contract, his next deal. So I guess it's a good thing for them.
Yeah, they I mean, Brandon Williams is arguably better than he is right now. And then you've got Jernigan. They've got a couple of draft picks that didn't play last year that they really like. So I think they love their depth on the D-line. That's the big thing. And plus, they needed to save the money on Ngata to get under the cap. But speaking of the cap, so right now the Ravens have $15 million committed in dead money to Ray Rice and Pitta, who Pitta maybe is going to play, but you know, it's maybe a little less than likely that he's going to play at this point. So how do you feel that those two contracts are really kind of forcing their hand a little bit, and then just their cap problems overall?
Well, I mean, the Ray Rice dead money, I think, is the real killer there. I mean, Pitta, at some point, you would like to think he can get back on the field. You can get, at least get something out of him. But I think where this will actually help is, I think you even alluded to it just in this last statement, by saying how much young talent that the Ravens have on that roster. Maybe it's about time, you know, you maybe wanted to go ahead with guys like Jernigan and stuff like that, maybe a year or two earlier than you wanted to, but this is the time that you're going to have to take advantage of it and really draft smart and really, you know, make sure those picks count once the end of April comes, because that's really how you're going to be able to manage and, you know, sort of tread water while you still have to deal with all that dead money with Ray Rice.
Yeah, I think people are ignoring the depth and talent that the Ravens have on the lines, and then, you know, and even their linebacking core is really solid, and, you know, people I think are Ravens fans every year go through this and people panic, but every year they get out of it because of the way that they draft. But the areas that they're a little thin in right now are like the skill position, especially, you know, outside of Flacco. So the Torrey Smith signing to San Francisco, did you feel, now cap issues aside, is that a deal that you felt that the Ravens should have been more aggressive to try to get close to, or is that just too far out there that you wouldn't have wanted to touch that if you were them?
I don't know if you would have wanted to really touch that one, because he got, what, 5 years from the Niners at $8 million per?
Mm-hmm. That's 22 guaranteed.
That's a little high. I mean, as far as, I mean, maybe you could have maybe done like a good faith type of thing and at least maybe put on a show for everyone and say, hey, we're going to negotiate, but, you know, obviously with the intention that they're not going to be able to match what the 49ers are. And it seemed like he really wanted, I don't want to say that he wanted to leave per se, but he did really seem to love that deal with the Niners, and it was, you know, kind of all the way with him. I wouldn't have touched that deal. I think, you know, if he can get that type of money from San Francisco, you know, kind of have to look at it and say, well, God bless you, you know, good luck, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Now, one of the guys that Ravens fans are kind of hoping that they can sign is Andre Johnson. So, personally, I think he's going to end up a Colt, but if not, what do you think the Ravens' chances are of being able to sign Andre Johnson?
I mean, it looks pretty good that he's going to end up in Indy. I mean, especially, you know, after talking with Frank Gore and doing all that other stuff, it looks really good that he's going to end up there. But I think they've got – I mean, I was going to say that if he wasn't going to end up in Indy, I don't want to say I was afraid of this happening, but because it just seems like a type of thing. Like, I would imagine he would have had a good chance of ending up in New England.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
because doesn't that just come off as a Patriots signing?
Yeah,
you know,
I wouldn't have been surprised by that either. I mean, there was also talk of Seattle, too.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
And the last guy on the offense, so the Ravens, obviously, they right now Justin Forsett is a free agent, and they've got Talaferro, who was a bit player last year, and Bernard Pierce, who hasn't done much. If you were the Ravens, knowing that this running back class in – the draft is pretty good, and there's a lot of depth in free agency. Would you really want to give Forsett, you know, $3-4 million a year, knowing your cap issues, when you can probably bring in a similar or better talent for a lot less money right now?
No, I think you hit it right on the head. I mean, that's so true, because the fact that you would not want to overextend yourself with a big deal for Forsett, and because this class is deep in wide receivers and running backs. So you can actually address, you know, a couple of your issues right then and there in this draft if you draft smart and you take the right guy. Running back, there's plenty of guys that are available. You could probably get even the second or third round, you'll get someone who can play, who can get out there and ball. And same thing as a wide receiver. You can probably find someone in the second or third round, fourth round even, you know, who's going to be, has a really good chance of being a steady contributor. So this is the one thing that's actually a, you know, ace in the hole for the Ravens, is the fact that this draft is very good in areas where they need help.
All right, Sid, so let's get away from the Ravens here. Lots of action to discuss around the league. Where do you think Darrell Revis is going?
Well, I mean, from the reports that we've been seeing is that the Patriots are sort of you know, taking it into consideration that he looks like he might want to be a Jet. I mean, it's the Jets. They have a real big track record of paying a lot of money for people that they really can't afford. I would not be surprised if he ends up in New York again, which would be kind of crazy. But I also would not be surprised if it seems like with Revis, the money is very important to him. You know, he's got his ring now. He's got his championship. He was a, you know, extremely important part of that Super Bowl winning team. I think he wants to get paid. And if he's going to go, and this is, by the way, I'm not knocking him because I feel that pretty much everyone should be this way in the NFL. It's such a violent sport. I mean, if the Jets are going to give him the most money, he'll go back there and not think twice. But it's going to be an AFC East race. It's going to be either the Jets or the Patriots. I don't see him going any other place.
There was a report that Rex Ryan might want to try to meet with him. Do you think there's any chance he ends up in Buffalo?
Sure, why not? I mean, if the Bills can swing a deal and find the money for him, yeah. I mean, I know that Terrell always loved playing for Rex, so yeah, absolutely. I mean, they could be, yeah, that's a good point. They could be a player at some point, but I still think the Jets are the leader in the clubhouse.
Speaking of the top defensive players, the Ndamukong Suh contract, which is waiting to get announced, that was done 3 days ago, despite what the league wants to say. Does that seem like a contract that just Miami is just going to regret in 3 or 4 years, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say that because it's so, you know, it's such a pessimistic attitude to take. But how many times have we seen deals like this? You know, someone throwing $80 million at a defensive tackle, and it never works. You know, and now that, you know, the Dolphins have thrown $123 million at Sue, they've had to cut half their defense, it seems, to fit him under the cap. And Sue's a little different. He's a lot younger, maybe, than like an Albert Haynesworth was when he got that big money deal in Washington. And I don't think he'd be, you know, I think he's a much more motivated player naturally than Haynesworth was. So I don't think you're going to have that issue. But it's one guy on a defense who you have to suit up 11. And I just don't, you know, based on previous track record, I don't see this ending up well. But listen, I'm not, you know, I'm hoping for the best. You know, I don't want to see him fail down there, but just previous history has not looked good for things like this.
Well, yeah, I heard some discussion about this yesterday, and, you know, a lot of the things that Sue does so well won't appear in the box score, and, you know, that will get fans down because it'll make it look like he's not producing because he's not getting a bunch of sacks or something, but that's not necessarily his game. But he
never really did that in Detroit either.
Right,
like his numbers
right.
were never – he's not a numbers guy, you know?
Is there – in this league, can you win paying $8 to $10 million in guaranteed money to a defensive tackle? Do you think? I mean, can you? I mean, barring the fact if you're, you know, you have an ace quarterback like, you know, like say like Luck and Wilson have been, especially Russell Wilson making no money. But beyond having that lucky of a situation, can you win in this league having that much money tied up into one player who really is just kind of a space eater?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, it depends on really who the guy is. Yeah, I mean, maybe on a defensive tackle type of a guy, that might be – I think that's unnecessary to pay someone that much money. But if you had, like, for example, like a Reggie White or somebody like that on the – like a pass.
J.J. Watt, yeah.
Or, yes, exactly. There you go, J.J. Watt or somebody like that. You know, I think, yes, paying someone like him would help because there's, like, a tangible result, I guess, maybe you could say. Because he can do so many different things from his spot. He can line up on either side. He can rush the passer. He can stuff the run. He can back down past the line of scrimmage. There's no stopping. There's no end to the things that he can do. So, but, I mean, when it comes to someone like Sue, even as much of a fan as I am of him, I think he's amazing. I just don't know paying that much money if you're going to get the returns that you want.
All right, fair enough there. Another big move. Today was Jimmy Graham to the Seattle Seahawks. Max Unger going back and a first-round draft pick, I believe, to the Saints, and a fourth round, I believe, from the Saints to the Seahawks. What do you think of that deal?
I mean, on paper, there's, you know, not much not to love about it, but at the same time, you know, one of the Seahawks' biggest problems was along the offensive line. They just didn't have, you know, they didn't have really consistent play up front. Now, granted, they've had a lot of injuries there, and, you know, but every team has that. And now they've traded away to their best, I mean, arguably their best offensive lineman to get Jimmy Graham. I guess you got to give to get. But it's Graham doesn't block much, and the who they have left on the offensive line other than Russell Okung is kind of shaky at best. So here's hoping that they've got some other plans of someone, you know, contingency plans of somebody they can throw up front and really develop, because as of right now they've still got problems with their offensive line. But, you know, listen, on paper Graham is a huge target. It's kind of funny because the one team that really made Jimmy Graham look bad over the last 3 years has been Seattle. So now he doesn't have to worry about them anymore. And who knows, maybe going up against Cam Chancellor and stuff like that in practice, he'll maybe get a little tougher. Hey, you have no problem throwing him on the one-yard line, right?
I haven't gotten a chance to read it yet. There was an article that Football Outsiders wrote, and they were making a case for trading Drew Brees. Do you think now with Graham kind of going, and you know they're getting younger, is I mean, I know obviously you can't replace Drew Brees, but he's going to start declining at some point. Do you think there's a case to be made to trade him right now if you're the Saints?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds good. I think what they would rather do is develop their own younger talent, someone behind Drew Brees. Going forward, I mean, they've already started having meetings with like guys like Jameis Winston and stuff like that. I think they're really going to start thinking seriously and sort of openly about trying to find his replacement, someone that can eventually take the job from him, in a couple of years. But I think having a veteran presence still there while your younger quarterback develops is invaluable. I don't think that I get it, and I've heard a lot of the theories, and I can't argue with it. But at the same time, I just don't think that they're going to do that with him. Now, I could be totally wrong. I just don't think they're going to do that with him.
What are your thoughts on what's going on in San Francisco? I think some of the stuff that people are getting upset about is a little overblown. Like, I mean, I think they should be happy that Frank Gore is gone, not because he's a bad player, but you have Carlos Hyde. You spent a second-round pick. This is why you drafted him, that type of thing. But just overall, what are your thoughts on what's going on over there?
I mean, it's like you have to, get therapy for all the 49er fans that you know. I mean, they're crying into their morning cereal. It's ridiculous. I mean, people got to buck up a little bit. It's not that bad. You know, like you said, about Frank Gore, he's on the wrong side of 30. He's a running back. True, he's had a lot of great years. But, you know, at some point it has to end. And like you said, they do have a lot of – Carlos Hyde's a very talented running back. They did just bring in Torrey Smith. I mean, losing Patrick Willis sucks. That's a terrible thing to have happen, but it wasn't like he retired because, you know, he just physically couldn't do it anymore. Ayupati is a nice player to have, but at the same time, I don't think he swings the pendulum one way or the other. I think, you know, the people need to sort of chill out, relax, wait for the draft, let the 49ers put together the team they want to do, and, for their sake, I hope they know what they're doing, because they basically, getting rid of Harbaugh, whatever they want to say, there was a mutual, split. It wasn't. And getting rid of Harbaugh and then having a few free agent losses, it looks bad in the interim, but, people need to breathe, give them some time and see what they can do in the draft and throughout the rest of free agency. I don't think it's time to push the panic button.
The one guy that, Chris Borland was really good for them last year. He got tons of tackles and all, replacing Patrick Willis. So do you think there's – Patrick Willis obviously was a great player, but do you think there's going to be a huge drop-off, especially thinking that maybe Willis was going to drop off himself because of the injury, even if he had not retired?
Yeah, and I think he did – he did play, and he got a lot of good experience, and he played well. Like you said, he played well. So I think 49er fans will be somewhat pleasantly surprised. It's not going to be the, oh, my God, we went from a top 10 defense to, bottom five. It's not going to be like that. People need to relax.
Go ahead, Mike.
All right, so Sid, what do you think of this Bradford trade to the Eagles? It seems like a lot to give up from Philadelphia's side.
Well, and also, I don't understand, the only way this trade makes sense is if they have another one planned in the future. Because I think as of right now, if you just make this trade straight up, I think, in my opinion, I think they got worse at the quarterback position. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, I just have to imagine that Chip really, really loves Sam Bradford. I mean, otherwise, yeah, that's what it seems like on paper, but Chip has a unique system, relatively unique system, and I guess, you know, Bradford is a good fit in Chip's eyes.
I guess. I mean, at the same time, it's just, you know, Bradford is just so brittle. I just don't understand. I don't get it. And then they have this, you know, one conditional second round pick, which is kind of crazy. So if Sam Bradford doesn't win the starting job, then the Eagles get to keep their second round draft pick they gave up for him. Okay, so what is going on again? It was one of those things that when you see it, you're just scratching your head, because it was such a weird time, because it happened right after the, it's like Jimmy Graham trade, then Nada, then this story, then you're sitting around there staring at your computer, just going, what in the world is going on?
Yeah,
I mean, I don't get it.
For me, I mean, the draft picks are bad enough, but I mean, why are you just trading Foles for him to begin with? I mean, even taking the draft picks out of it, it does, like you said, it seems like it's a downgrade. I don't think Foles is anything spectacular. You know,
no,
he's not a 29-touchdown, 2-interception guy like he was a few years ago. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, he has proven that he can be very good in your system, so why even make the move to begin with?
That's exactly my point. It's just kind of like, I don't really get what the – I have to imagine that he's got some other deal up his sleeve, because as of right now, you know, I don't understand what they're doing. They brought back Mark Sanchez, so now what? You got Sam Bradford versus Mark Sanchez for the starting job. I'm going, it's not a position that I would want to be in. Put it that way.
Yeah, very odd. All right, so Sid, last question for you. Out of the moves we have not talked about, any moves that you especially like or dislike?
That we have not talked about, that have already happened?
Yep. Or that are very, very likely to happen.
It's kind of funny, because I was talking it over with a couple of the other guys here, and I was kind of saying, you know, as far as the first day of free agency goes, where it just comes to signings, I mean, I have to give it like a C-, right? I mean, what have you seen that's been really that sexy, you know, other than the trades, you know? You've got A.J. Hawk to the Bengals, okay. You've got LeSean McCoy finalizing his new contract. You've got a couple other signings that are kind of nice here and there. But I mean, I really want to see where DeMarco Murray is going to end up, especially when that whole thing broke this morning, how he scrubbed all the Cowboys stuff on his Twitter account. There's so much drama there. But, I mean, look for a team that maybe you might have not have heard of, maybe like the Jaguars or something like that, all of a sudden signing DeMarco Murray. That would be crazy. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but, you know, I think at this point, the rumors that I'm hearing could be, you know, a team that you were not thinking of could just come in and sign someone like him.
Yeah, be interested to see what happens there, Sid. So obviously, you know, people should check out foxsports.com. You want to mention anything specific in terms of what you're working on or what you have over there at Fox?
Well, we got a lot of breaking news coming down. We got our senior writers, Mike Garofolo and Jay Glazer, obviously breaking news by the minute. So come to foxsports.com/NFL. We'll have daily wrap-ups of all the free agent signings, and come check it out. You'll have a lot of fun.
All right, Sid, you want to let the listeners know your Twitter handle?
Yes, you can come follow me at RealSidSaraf.
All right, Sid, thanks a lot, as always, and have a great night.
All right, guys, take care.
You too. All right, so some good stuff there from Sid. We're going to be joined by John Gassaway from ESPN in just a moment. I will make one comment about the Sue deal. I don't think it's fair to call him a space eater. He's a legitimate disruptive force beyond just, you know, taking up space. So I know you kind of like couched it like kind of like a space eater or whatever. But, you know, he's a big-time pass rusher and gets in the backfield and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, since he came into the league, he leads defensive tackles in sacks, but it's only like 36.5 sacks. Now it's not fair to say space eater. I mean, Ted Washington was a space eater, you know. So he's a lot more than that. But what I kind of meant was his impact in the game is his ability to take up multiple offensive linemen so that, you know, so that linebackers can roam freer and things like that. Same thing that we've seen with defensive tackles here in Baltimore with guys like Nada and whatnot. So that's his main function. A guy like J.J. Watt can impact the game more because he can, like Sid was saying, he can do many different things and be on different spots on the line. Mizzou's not really necessarily that guy. Now, he's a lot more disruptive than most defensive tackles are, so it's not fair to compare him to, like, a normal defensive tackle. I agree with that. But that's his biggest function, is his ability to take on double and triple teams and allow everybody else in the line to free. I mean, one of the guys I heard talked about is, now, what will Deion Gordon become? He was the third pick in the draft a few years ago. He's been kind of a bust. You know, now all of a sudden with a guy like Sue on there and you've got Cameron Wake on the other side, does that free him up to where maybe he becomes kind of a very good pass rusher? And that will be more because of Sue's ability than probably because of his. So those are the type of things that don't come up on in the box score, which is where this people are going to struggle to judge this deal, I think, because a defensive tackle's job isn't necessarily something that you're going to see in the box score, and that's what people want to see.
Sure. I would just say, his main attribute or value is taking on, you know, 2-3 blockers, but also taking those blockers and still being disruptive beyond just, like, taking up the blockers, which is, you know, typically what a lot of those Ravens guys would do for Ray Lewis. All right, so let's welcome John Gassaway from ESPN. How you doing tonight, John?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So, John, in your years of analyzing the college game, how high does this Kentucky team rank compared to the other teams over the years?
They are right there at the top, but you know what? They've got company this year, much less over the years. I know that they've managed to make it this far undefeated, and if I had to pick a national champion, I would go with UK. But I've got to say, teams like Arizona and Villanova and Duke look awfully good late in the season, and things are about to get much, much tougher for the Wildcats than they have been in the SEC, and that's why we love the SEC tournament, is to see a team like Kentucky challenged finally for the first time in a long while. Should be a great spectacle.
Well, John, most of our listeners can stop listening right now because I'm going to talk about Duke and they don't want to hear that in Maryland. But a couple thoughts. I know you recently wrote something for ESPN talking about them peaking at the right time right now offensively. So what is it about their offense that you look at and say, this is an offense that can win a national championship?
Well, I think people underrate the non-Okafor aspects of the Duke offense. They understand, just as a point of conversation, yes, Duke has lots of great players. Yeah, a lot of them are really talented freshmen, just like Jahlil Okafor. But at the end of the day, it seems like people aren't grasping that there's more here than just the guy who will be the number one or possibly number two overall pick. And one of the things I zeroed in on in the piece that you mentioned, so really over the balance of the ACC season, and definitely over the last half, despite North Carolina's reputation for being an outstanding offensive rebounding team, and they are, Duke was actually superior. This is a really good offensive rebounding unit. Obviously, Okafor is great in that direction. Nobody sits around and says, boy, Emile Jefferson and, you know, Plumlee, those are great players, but they're both very good offensive rebounders. So at any time you've got one or even two of those guys on the floor, and they erase a lot of misses. The other thing I pointed out was that Justice Winslow is an effective source of points inside the arc. Nobody's like Okafor on that front, of course, but there are other options for points inside the arc, and Winslow and Quinn Cook definitely come to mind. So it's a really effective combination on offense.
Now, the one thing that could hold Duke back is defense. They had been ranked very highly in defensive efficiency this year, up until they had their two-game stretch with Miami and NC State, and then they really fell off. And then since
right.
then they've kind of just stayed in that general area. Do you think their defense? I mean, I've seen basically every game this year, and for me, I think their defense it has its lapses. Don't get me wrong, but I think it's better than some of the defensive efficiency numbers say that it is. Do you agree with that, or you disagree with that?
Well, I think it's sufficiently good, even on paper. I mean, this is an average, even slightly better than average ACC defense. So you combine that with, you know, definitely one of the best three offenses in the country, And, you know, I'll write that. I'll take that. Opponents, you know, shooting from the floor is exactly the ACC average, not better, not worse. So that's a good sign, you know. Same thing with opponent two-point shooting. This is an okay defense, you know. It's not a earth shaker by any means, but Coach K loves pushing opponents off of the three-point line, as we all know. And this defense does that. So, you know, it's tough. Yeah, it's tough for teams to replicate those explosions that Miami had, that had everybody, and NC State had, although that was a little more explainable because that was at least on the road for Duke. But those seem like a while ago, and as you indicate, the defense has been steady and not spectacular ever since. So I think, I came out today and said that Duke is one of the six teams that I think could win the national championship. And, obviously baked into that calculation is an assessment that I think outstanding offense and average defense will be sufficient to get the job done.
All right, John. So let's get away from Duke, talk about the Terps. They are, amazingly 26-5. I'm pretty shocked by that, to be honest. 14-4 in the Big Ten. They've done a tremendous job winning close games. Now, whether that can continue going here into the Big Ten tournament and then into the real tournament remains to be seen. But what are your thoughts on how they've played this year and how they look going into the tourneys?
Well, I think you're right to be I'm not sure if shocked is the right word. I mean, thrilled would be a good word, because they're in line for a three seed. And, if anybody had said that, at the beginning of the season, you just would have been stunned. And so it's been a great ride. And a three seed is a tremendous benefit. I mean, my gosh, what you're saying is, no worries about, you won't see Kentucky that first weekend. You won't see Arizona, no Duke, no Virginia, no Villanova. You just take care of business, beat that 14 seed and then see what feisty 6 seed or perhaps 10 comes your way. That is a great situation to be in. I would take that situation for my team in a heartbeat. So hats off to Mark Turgeon. And the other thing, I wrote extensively today about Duke's record. I got Duke in my brain. Look what happened. About Maryland's record in close games. And that is, it is striking and extreme historically, and we can get into that. But one thing that I don't want to lose sight of is that Maryland is good enough to be in all of these close games to start with. And the reason they are, and something that people lose sight of, because Des Wells and Melo Trimble are so fun to watch on offense, is that this is a very good defense. One of the better ones, in fact, in the Big Ten. And they are solid, and they force misses, and that's partly attributable to guys who get less publicity than Trimble and Wells do. And Turgeon has done an excellent job on that side of the ball. So it's no mistake that these games are all coming down to the wire. It's partly a function of the fact that teams cannot score enough against Maryland, and that's to Turgeon's credit.
All right, so let's get into this close game situation. We've dealt with this in the Baltimore area with the Orioles recently as well, winning a lot of close games, people writing about, luck and all of that. So where do you stand on, how much this is skill versus, random variance or whatever you want to call it? And, how sustainable do you think it is going forward?
Well, the smart play is to, beat your NCAA tournament opponent by a larger margin, and then you don't have to worry about whether it's sustainable or not. That's what Turgeon and his team are going to try to do. Now, if you continue playing close games, you will at some point lose. Can you do it all the way through an NCAA tournament and win? Well, most everything's been done once in the 75 years that they've been playing the tournament. John Wooden's last team, to cite one obscure example, played a ton of close games on their way to a national championship. So sure, it can be done. But the odds, of course, are against you. Michigan State a few years ago played nothing but close games. It got to the Final Four and then they stop there. Maryland is stands out this season, it is true, in terms of teams that have outscored their conferences by as much as the Terrapins have. You know, Maryland does have the best record of any of the teams over the last few years. So it's been a great run, and I think they have an advantage because in Wells and Trimble, they've got guys who can draw fouls almost at will. And Jake Lehman also, of course, does that. But Wells and Trimble are really out there on that. And, no, you can't win close games forever. You will lose one occasionally. But, you know, they're in the tournament, and they're a three seed, and they've definitely got the momentum. So this is going to be a fun team to watch.
Yeah, so if they are a three seed, like how far do you think is realistic for this team to go in the tournament?
You do have to see the bracket. I mean, you know, yeah. It could be a case where you say, whoa, that was a tough six. You know, Wichita State, the state, to take one example, I'm seeing on the five line in some mocks, which is probably too low right there. And if they were somehow to slip to a six, through any chain of events, I, for one, would rate Wichita State as a neutral floor favorite over Maryland. So you do have to see the brackets. But, you know, if you're a three, it's the opportunity is there. You know, Wichita State, I cite, because that's an exception to the rule. Maryland is going to be favored in its first game, definitely, and it has a high probability of being favored in its second game. And, you know, that's all you can ask for. That's a great opportunity. So sight unseen, I would say Maryland can get to the Sweet 16. I might reverse my opinion once I see the brackets come out.
Well, John, they got to win that first game first. And we saw last year, you know, Mercer was a 14 seed and beat Duke as a 3 seed, and those types of upsets are happening every year. So, at the teams that that are likely to make the tournament of these smaller conferences, that'll be 13, 14 seeds somewhere around there. Because I agree with you, I think Maryland's floor at this point is a 4 seed, and I think their ceiling is a 2. But I think they have to win the Big Ten tournament and beat Wisconsin. I don't see that happening. But whether they're a 3 or a 4 seed, are there any teams out there? Whether it's teams that could face Maryland or just in general that are in those lower seeds that you could see pulling off one of those upsets that we seemingly see every year?
Well, I'll stick to the 13s and 14s because once you get below a 14, you're talking about something massive and epic like, you know, Norfolk State over Missouri a few years ago, which, by the way, was great fun. If you're not a Missouri fan, that was a great game. But I'll stick a little higher than that so we're not so far out on a ledge. And you know, I've seen the same mock brackets you are. So the teams that stand out, you know, whoever comes out of the Ivy, for example, whether that's Harvard or Yale coming out of the playoff game on Saturday, that the Ivy representative will have talent. I'll put it that way. Good players, and it looks like that'll be a 13 seed. So that's definitely a matchup to watch. I'm on the record this year as really liking Corey Hawkins from UC Davis. If they draw a 13 seed, that could be fun to watch. And then Eastern Washington with, I don't know if he's the leading scorer at the moment in the nation. It changes day by day. But I've written this year about Tyler Harvey. Great story. Not only is he the leading scorer in the country at Eastern Washington, but he went to Eastern Washington as a walk-on at Eastern Washington, and now he's the leading scorer in the country. He's a great shooter. So these are all teams that can score. And my lower, you know, my preferred style for the lower seeds to pull upsets are run-and-gun kind of teams opposed to gritty defensive outfits, because I think you know, if you can score points, it's a little easier to freak out the major conference opponent you're playing than it is to say, ooh, we're going to stop you. You know, we're a tough defense. So those are the teams that come to mind.
Okay, so speaking of that defensive mentality, the team that in the ACC that we're seeing with that is obviously Virginia.
Right.
The Justin Anderson situation, I would assume, has to impact the answer to your question on this. But with a team like – Virginia, who is a good, efficient offense, but they're not a team that can usually score a lot. And obviously they're a great defensive team. How deep do you see this team going into the tournament? They should definitely be a one seed at this point. I guess if they lost their first game in the ACC tournament, there's a danger that they're not a one. But I think at this point they should get a one. How much do you like this team, and how deep do you think that they, you know, realistically can go?
I like them a lot if Justin Anderson can come back. And the latest from Tony Bennett is that he doesn't know. I believe him. I don't think he's being coy. I think that's they just have to wait and see. And I think that Virginia would be in a situation where they would like Anderson to get some low-impact kind of possessions at the ACC tournament just to kind of get him in shape for the NCAA tournament. But assuming that he can be healthy, he had the evaluative politeness to suffer his injury right in the middle of the ACC season, making it perfect for guys like me to go in and say, okay, we've got, great test case here. This is what Virginia was before, and this is what they were after. And he makes a significant difference on offense. They turn the ball over much more often without him, and this won't surprise anyone. They're a much better three-point shooting team with him. So if Virginia has a healthy Anderson, I do have them as one of my teams that can win the national championship. They are better on defense than they are on offense, even with a healthy Anderson. But people tend to underrate how good they are on offense if he's there, mainly because they hold on to the ball about as well as Wisconsin does. So it's cumulatively effective. And you look up and you're like, wow, they scored over a point per possession. It didn't seem like it, but they really did. So as you said in your question, a lot of it does hinge on Anderson's health.
Now, if you're a Virginia fan, are you worried about Justin Anderson coming back too late and not being able to integrate himself into the offense, kind of like what we saw similar like with Kyrie Irving with Duke? And obviously that was a different situation because he's he was the point guard and you had the Nolan Smith issue. But, I mean, just in general, are you worried about that situation for them?
Yes, absolutely I am. I want him. That's why, if I'm Tony Bennett, I want Justin Anderson, and he's cleared by the doctors, I want him playing in the first ACC tournament game for that reason that you mentioned. And there's nothing on the line at the ACC tournament for Virginia. I can't imagine that they would lose a one seed even if they lost their first game. I just think they're locked in. So, if you are Tony Bennett, for precisely the reason you name, get Anderson on the floor and let any ugliness happen there, work out the kinks there against an overmatched foe early in the ACC tournament before you're playing for real in the NCAA. And then, ideally you would think they'd be facing a 16 seed, and that would be yet another opportunity to kind of work out the kinks in a more low-intensity environment before the challenges start for real.
All right, John. We greatly appreciate your time. I just want to ask you one last question here on your Twitter, at John Gassaway. You recently said that, scoring in the regular season was down 3.2% in major conference play. This is a big issue for me personally, because scoring has been, down already before that, and it's just, I like to see a little bit more offense, and I don't think it's really a situation where it's because there's great defense typically. I just think, the quality of offense has really suffered. So do you feel it's a big problem, and are there any solutions you can mention?
Well, I'm in the curious position of favoring a reduction in the shot clock, and that's something that one set of people agrees with me at the same time, I'm not a scoring essentialist, so that's another group of people that allies with me on that one. I see great games all the time. Louisville, Virginia, at Louisville the other night was a fantastic game, and that only had about 55 possessions, and the final score was in the high 50s, low 60s. And that was an intense, hard-fought, well-played, exciting game, and the crowd was going nuts. So it's not as easy as just saying, 58 points, that game stinks. But I just don't think there's any legitimate reason for the shot clock to be 35 seconds. No other shot clock in the world is 35 seconds. Just take it to 30. Let's have a little less east-west motion in our offenses, a little more north-south, going straight to the basket, and I think we'll find we can live without those 5 seconds. So I guess I'm a little from column A, a little from column B kind of guy on this question.
All right. Sounds good, John. Definitely agree with reducing the shot clock. All right. So let us know what you have going on at ESPN.
It's March, so just go to ESPN, and I'll be there every day. tomorrow, look for my thoughts. I talked to some coaches and then did some research on my own on the question of whether it really matters if you do well in your conference tournament, whether that momentum transfers the NCAA tournament or not. So at ESPN.com tomorrow, there's a good tease.
All right, John, thanks a lot. We greatly appreciate you taking some time out of your very busy March schedule. So have a great night.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. All right. So, Rob, any quick takeaways there?
I mean, John's, I don't know how many people really follow him or not. He's kind of like a Ken Pom guy. I mean, he's really knowledgeable about the game and the possession stuff. there were a lot of other things that I would like to have gotten into with him. He mentioned that he feels that there are six teams that can win. He mentioned Duke and Kentucky and Arizona and Villanova. It sounds like he thinks Virginia would be one of them. I don't know who the sixth one is. Probably Wisconsin, because I know he's rated them pretty highly, especially because they're such an efficient offense. Not to get away from the tournament from what he said, but they really do have to do something with the shot clock. I mean, he's 100% right that there are still a lot of really good games. You know, go back to the first Duke North Carolina game that was 92-90. I mean, the one nice thing about that game, yes, the defenses did struggle in that game, but a lot of it had to do because it was great offense. And you know, you don't see enough consistent great offense in the college game anymore. And part of that, I think, is because of the shot clock. They recently, I'm not sure if you saw it, 2 weeks ago on College Game Day, they had Stephen A. Smith on, and they had a roundtable discussion with Jay Williams and Jay Billis and Seth Greenberg, and they were discussing the issues of the college game, and they were comparing it to the NBA game. And the question was asked to Stephen A. Smith, what does the college game do better than the NBA? And he said nothing. He said the only thing that the NBA, you don't get the atmosphere in most arenas, Golden State may be one of the exceptions, but for the most part, you don't get the atmosphere, he was saying, that you get in the college game. But you don't, which is the same thing in the NFL and college football too. But he was just saying the game is just much different. It's just a much better game in the NBA. And he said you have to drop the shot clock down. Now, one of the other things that people have talked about is getting rid of the zone in college. I don't agree with that necessarily. I don't think you have to have the exact same game. I don't have a problem saying, okay, a lot of these guys aren't as good, so we don't have to do the same thing. But I just don't understand the shot clock. John mentioned that nowhere else in the world has a shot clock at 35 seconds. One of the points that Jay Billis made was that he was at a high school girls game in Bethesda, Maryland, and they had a 30-second shot clock. So it doesn't make any sense. To me, you can even make the case that, you know, if not that the guys have to have a, just because it's men versus women, but if the women can have a 30-second shot clock, the guys should be, 27 seconds, 28 seconds? Stephen A. Smith thought it should be 24 seconds. I don't know if it has to go down to that point, but I wouldn't necessarily be upset if it did. But they've got to do something with it. You know, March will hide some of that issue because the tournament and the event of the tournament and everything is bigger than this issue. But throughout the season, you cannot deny that this is a problem with the game and it's got to be addressed.
Yeah, I agree. March Madness, people are going to watch that almost regardless of the quality play. I mean, it has some effect, of course, but you have a lot of people that I don't even think are really that big into college basketball, but then they like to fill out the bracket, and then because they filled out the bracket, then suddenly, like, it's so much more interesting. The bracket is, like, is such a tremendous, you know, invention or whatever for college basketball. It's tremendous PR. It really brings a lot of attention to March Madness. I think if you know, if you take away the bracket and the betting, any betting from March Madness, it's completely overrated in my opinion at this point based on the quality of play. But with the bracket and people betting and people caring about games that they otherwise, let's be honest, would not care about for the most part at all, then it becomes great because suddenly you're like, you're a huge fan of some team that you maybe probably haven't watched all season long, even like big college basketball fans that maybe watched 1 to 3 times all season long. And then you're like, oh, now I'm a big fan of this team because I have them in the bracket. So that's huge for college basketball, and that's going to obviously remain the case. But you're right about, you know, regular season or even in just in terms of helping out in the bracket, especially once you get down later, you know, you get people for the first weekend is, you know, the most exciting time for the bracket. And then you have people just like falling off because their brackets are busted or whatever. So later on, you know, Elite Eight, Final Four, then it really becomes a matter of, for a lot of people, is if you really want to watch the games or not, because your brackets aren't as consequential. And, you know, then it's just a matter of, you know, if you have a rooting interest and if you think the quality of play is good enough. And I think there are some issues there.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. I mean, you're right. It's the first four. I mean, okay, the tournament is great, but let's face it. Like you said, it's the first 4 days, and even more so than the first 4 days, it's those first 2 days because you have so many games going on and everything else, and nobody cares if a game is 50-45. They're just so into the game because, like you said, because of their brackets. But you're right. You want to keep that fan interest into the sport as people get eliminated from their bracket pools. And now, you know, now you get to the point where it's just like, okay, you don't want it to just be people who are either diehard college fans or people who are fans of that particular of the team that is playing. You still want those casual fans being involved in the sport. And you're right. And improving the pace of the play of the game is going to help that. You know, a guy like yourself, you're a big basketball fan. But you're not necessarily going to watch an Elite Eight game if it's two teams that just don't, you know, if it's Virginia against Wisconsin, you know, two teams that play slow. It's not that they're not good teams; it just may not be a game that interests you, even though those are two elite teams. So, you know, improving that is only going to help the casual college fan and college basketball fan. And let's face it, those are the fans that you need to get, because the hardcore gut fans and the fans of the teams that are you know that are, you know, the college teams themselves. Those people, there's only so many of those teams people you have to really get. It's the casual college basketball fans that you got, and the people like yourself who love basketball, who really go to the NBA, you know, that maybe would spend more time on the college game if they actually did something like that.
Yeah, and, you know, I am biased to the NBA at this point, and, you know, that's fair to say for people, but I used to be a huge college basketball fan, and I used to be more into college basketball than the NBA. There's multiple reasons why that is flip-flopped, and now I'm, you know, really barely into college basketball other than the Terps. And that's, you know, part of the reason is because the Terps have faltered, obviously having a nice renaissance this season. Part of that is, you know, the whole conference expansion and switching conferences and all that. I haven't really enjoyed that too much. Used to love the ACC as an 8 and or 9-team conference. You play each team twice and all that. You could really become more familiar with the players. Now it's really a lot of work, I think, to truly be pretty familiar with all the teams just in your conference and the players on a year-to-year basis, let alone, like, talking about nationally, because, you know, you have so much turnover, and when guys, like, the really good players a lot of times will leave and all that, but you have so many teams now, and all right, but anyway, enough of that rant. The other reason is obviously what we're talking about, just I think the quality of play has dropped quite a bit, and, you know, scoring is part of that. I don't think scoring has been consistently dropping because, you know, necessarily because of better defense or different strategies so much. I think it's a lot of it's just because, you know, offense is not good. So I don't think the shot clock is a cure-all. I think and you just need better offensive play in general. I'm not sure exactly how you create that. I know the block charge rule is very controversial in college. A lot of people think that there's way too much leeway towards the defensive player in that case. So if you can fix that up, that could help. But I don't know. It's a complex issue, obviously. And, you know, I don't know if I'll be coming back to college basketball in full force anytime soon.
Yeah, the block charge thing, that's something – that's another thing Jay Billis has talked about, that the only person that should be able to kind of draw that is the defender, not the off-ball defender. Most of the time, the officials are getting that wrong. So instead of putting that in, just take it away from them and just say, okay, the off-ball defender cannot be involved in a block charge call, and then that way the officials don't get it wrong. Because they get that call wrong most of the time. You know, and I'm not sitting there, I don't want to, like, bash the officials. It's a fast-paced game. It's tough to referee a basketball game. I'm not, you know, a bunch of people condensed in a small area. I mean, I'm not, it's just, that's why you just take it out of their hands. You know, it's you know, you can kind of, it's kind of like the ball strike thing in baseball. You know, I'm not saying it's an easy thing to umpire. It's tough. You know, so take the stuff that's tough out of their hands, you know, and let them do the stuff that's not as difficult. So I would like to see that. I would be in favor of that. In terms of just the better off, you're right. I mean, you know, the one-and-done thing, I don't know how much that really matters in terms of if you took that away and you just said players could go out of high school, you're still going to have a lot of one-and-dones, and you're going to have kids like Jahlil Okafor who, you know, are great college scorers, and, you know, their offense is fine. And you're going to have guys like that who don't go to college. So that they're going to – it's going to hurt. So I don't necessarily know the rule that would help the college game in terms of that would be it would be the baseball rule where you're making these guys stay for 3 years. And the reason for that is because you're going to get these guys that are going to be able to get to play together for 2 and 3 and 4 years. And then, so when you're able to do that, you're able to build a continuity, you're able to build an offense. I mean, you know, Virginia, you know, they're an efficient offense. They don't score a lot, but they're an efficient offense. And part of that, I mean, look at their team. They're full of sophomores, juniors, and seniors. And they're not getting the guys that are going to leave early. But they're able to build a good team, and they're able to build it over a few years to where now you have what they did last year and you've got this year. And if Justin Anderson stays in school, they're not losing much off of this year's team. So they're going to be able to have a 3-year run where they can be really good. And a big reason for that is because the kids aren't leaving early. So I think that's really the only solution, is that you kind of make the kids stay for 3 years, but I don't think that's a fair rule. So I don't think there really is a solution. You know, I think you just have to start with the shot clock and hope that is the beginning of what they're doing, but I would agree with you that it is not the cure-all for this.
Yeah, it would help, and I totally agree that, you know, the baseball rule, football rule, those are, yeah, I don't think they would be fair at all, you know, implying it to basketball, and, you know, I forgot to mention the other reason for my, you know, decline in interest in college basketball and college sports in general is kind of a distaste for the NCAA, so, you know, there's that as well. So, all right, I think we've talked about this enough. I have other things to do, but I will also mention I was very into my high school's, you know, playoff games here, basketball-wise, and they don't even have a shot clock, which is ridiculous. But, you know, they're going to the Final Four for the state of Maryland at College Park. But, yeah, there's times where they just hold the ball for, you know, extensive period of time, and it sucks. But it's exciting, even though it's low scoring for the most part, because, you know, I'm super invested in what happens in the game, and otherwise it wouldn't be that exciting. All right, so, Rob, any final comments?
Well, I just wanted to see one thing. I just saw on Twitter that that apparently Jacksonville is going after DeMarco Murray, and Sid Sarath mentioned that as not something necessarily that he thought would happen, but, you know, mentioned it as a possibility. So that's interesting. Jacksonville is somewhere that people want to go all of a sudden. So I guess it's because they have a lot of money.
Obviously, Jay Glazer or Adam Schefter, whoever broke that story, must be listening to this show. But yeah, anyway, everyone, thanks for listening. Have a great week. We'll be back next week. Should be previewing the tourney. So again, have a good evening.